Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marco Sippi.
On the show today, we'll be discussing Radical Matter, the new book by design and research specialists Kate Franklin and Caroline Till. They have been looking at how we can use materials, all materials, even the ones that smell bad, in more intelligent ways. Caroline will be joining us later.
Also today, a music legend, Eliades Ochoa, the Buena Vista Social Club member and Grammy-winning guitarist, will be talking through his career and his upcoming show for London's La Linnea Festival in a few weeks' time.
And we'll be meeting economist and broadcaster Darshini David. Her new book, The Almighty Dollar, traces the journeys that currencies take around the world before hopefully landing in your pocket.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with some of next week's news today. And we'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Tom, great to catch up with you in this studio again. It's been a while since the last time.
On the Monocle Weekly, Marcus, it has been. But there's, apart from 300 or 400 people, virtually no one I would rather spend my Sunday lunchtime with than you.
I was going to say the same thing to you. What have been the highlights of your week so far, by the way, besides being in the studio now with me?
Marcus, I have been a little under the weather earlier in the week.
Have you? What happened?
I'll be honest. I have a small child and there are a few of these little bugs and things that go around. I'll leave it to the listener's imagination. But can I just say, in a strange way, it's redoubled my commitment to make this show positively sing out of people's speakers or into their headphones.
Fair enough. Well, whilst you've been taking days off and getting better, I've been interviewing people and doing many interesting interviews. Actually, if you were wondering what was going on in the studio earlier, I had some Greek guests over. We talked about Greek food. And as a result, this studio
I thought there was a fragrant note of the delights of a Greek springtime.
I know we have principles that we should not be eating anything at studios, but still, nevertheless, it's the weekend, so I thought to break the rules sometime and be a rebel.
I like it. Well, Marcus, this idea of rebelliousness, clever, brilliant, innovative thinking is going to be front and centre throughout the whole of today's Monocle Weekly, after we speak to a traditional man of the news, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night, the stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. Though we never thought that we could lose, there's no regret.
What a song! Welcome, Fernando. How are you doing this weekend?
I'm feeling very good.
Now, I didn't realise, but you are actually named after the song Fernando by ABBA.
Well, I hope so. But
you know that's not true.
But you know, guys, every time I remember when I was single, you know, people used to make fun. Oh, Fernando, the song, I like it. You know, I think it's one of the best ABBA songs. Not only because it's named after me.
Shall we cast
So we continue with the news.
From the discography of ABBA to next week's news today. Where should we start, Fernando?
Well, let's start with something a bit serious. Today, Colombians are voting for their new parliament and their new Senate as well, which will be followed by the presidential elections in May, which I think that's the one everybody's looking forward to. And it's quite interesting this year because they've just been through like a peace process with FARC. So, you know, just so people know, I think FARC have 5 seats in Congress and 5 in the Senate, which are guaranteed for them. They could get more, but not less. And of course, the Colombian political scene is so fragmented. It's a bit like the Brazilian, you know, there's so many political parties and things are a bit uncertain at the moment.
How controversial is it still that FARC has now got those parliamentary seats?
It is controversial. I mean, you know, the peace process has been signed, but a lot of people are against, including the political party of Álvaro Uribe, which is from the right-wing party. But another interesting thing about this election, as you can see, guys, I have the Rolling Stone, the local edition of Rolling Stone, is Gustavo Petro. He's a leftist candidate, and he's polling ahead in the presidential election. So I think he'll have quite a strong influence in this parliament elections. And other funny things that Colombia traditionally has been very close to the US, so they tend to be slightly more right-wing than the other countries in South America. But I think things are changing because he used to be a former guerrilla leader, not FARC, another one, but a bit like Dilma Rousseff in Brazil and among others as well in the region.
That's one of your serious news stories. I wonder how serious the next one is going to be.
Well, guys, for me, it's quite serious, actually, if not more.
Is it Eurovision now?
It is Eurovision. And guys, I'm so happy this year.
Why?
Because we have a Brazilian in Eurovision.
Really?
This is like the summit of all you can ever have dreamed of. back in Sao Paulo, no?
To be honest, it's the second time that happened, but the first time was 96. I was far too young.
So who is this Brazilian and which country does this person represent?
So it's her name is Laura Rizzotto. She's representing Latvia. She was born in Rio de Janeiro. And I have to say, of course, I'm always a big fan of the Latvian entries. They're very left-field, some electronic beats. And I think Laura did a fantastic job as well. And I think she'll be... In fact, I have a clip, guys. Shall we play
it? Oh, you have to listen to this. So this is Miss Rizzotto herself.
Yes,
from
exactly.
Latvia now.
Let's jump in. You're looking at her, she's looking at you. I'm falling apart, what can I do to make you feel that way about me too? Yeah, yeah. And it's getting hard, I'm not gonna lie. To keep in the dark, all I'm feeling inside. When you're walking, smelling like her perfume. But what's that thinking? I'm just the funny girl to you.
Funny girl to you, that was the Latvian entry at this year's
Beautiful.
Eurovision, Rizzotto.
Rizzotto.
Born in Brazil originally. Tom Edwards, I was wondering, you have an ear for winning Eurovision tracks. What would your analysis of this track be?
I think it's interesting. I think, so is it her father is a Brazilian-Latvian?
Yeah,
is this
correct? He's a Latvian-Brazilian. Her grandmother was born in Latvia. And, you know, her career, actually, I think she started, of course, in Brazil, trying to be a singer. And then she became a Portuguese coach language for Jennifer Lopez. Because, you know, that's why Jennifer Lopez keep releasing sometimes songs in Portuguese.
Does it work?
Because Laura was helping her all
I
the
see.
Time.
And she thought, hold tight, I'll have a bash at this myself.
Exactly.
Is it though, Fernando, and you have such a seasoned watcher's and listener's ear, enough to take the big prize? I'm not sure it had quite the Eurovision winning dynamic, but you never know.
I have to be honest, because, you know, the reason why I chose as a new story, because by tomorrow, actually, is the last day the countries should submit their songs to the Eurovision committee. If you're late, you're out of the competition. And funnily enough, I checked the odds to see who are the favorites. Mm-hmm. And then Bulgaria is number one, but they haven't released their song yet. So it's a bit strange.
Strange,
so, isn't it? So I wouldn't really trust the odds at
who,
the moment.
Who is going to win then, just from the Fernando-ometer?
Who are your favorites?
Well, I think Estonia might have a little bit of a chance. They have an operatic singer. Her name is Eliana Nechayeva with La Forza. It's and Marcos, actually, your country might do better than last year's. I don't think it's a winner.
Anyway, well, everyone can see. When is it? Lisbon in when?
Lisbon on the 12th of May.
There you go. See you there. Faye, time is short. Anything else happening this week? What about in the culture, elsewhere in the cultural firmament?
Yeah, very interesting. And I don't want to focus only on this film. But this Friday in the US, they will release the new Tomb Raider with Alicia Vikander as the main actress. Of course, we had the ones in the early noughties with Angelina Jolie, which I thought was quite great. The critics don't agree with me. But
I haven't seen them and I plan to keep it that way.
Yes. Well, we should see the sequel tones, even better than the first. But the funny story here is, finally Hollywood, I mean, I know it's a story we've been hearing since the Oscars, are having big blockbusters with female leads or minority leads. And I don't think it's just the token film, like, oh, let's say Wonder Woman the whole year. I mean, just look, I have here a calendar of the upcoming releases. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic. You have, for example, this weekend we had the new A Wrinkle in Time, which the main lead is a very young black actress. You also have Annihilation with Natalie Portman, Red Sparrow with Jennifer Lawrence, and even Pacific Rim Uprising with John Boyega, very, very good British actor. There's so many to choose, actually. Even Ant-Man, you have a sequel called Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is, is a woman. So I find it very exciting. Of course, let's not forget, Black Panther did more than $1 billion in the box office already.
Exactly. It's good to see that change. Thank you very much. It's an exciting week ahead. That was Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be discussing unconventional design with Caroline Till in just a moment.
Design and research specialists Kate Franklin and Caroline Till make up Studio Franklin Till, which focuses on how we can use materials more intelligently. And in an era when our impact on the planet is becoming an ever more urgent concern, it's high time we looked more closely at what we throw away and why.
The duo's new book, Radical Matter, collects much of this research, some of which also finds its way into their regular design periodical Viewpoint. And the book showcases a generation of makers using some truly unconventional resources to make everyday objects, discarded plastic, for example, or even human waste.
Well, Caroline Till joins us now to discuss it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Caroline. Very good to have you with us. And let's pick up on what Marcus was talking about there. It seems almost like there are tricks of the creative and design and manufacturing process that the book talks about. And it's interesting, I can't remember whether it's in the foreword or in the introduction, this word alchemy comes up. Do we need a bit of creative alchemy? Is there some magic dust to sprinkle into the mix as well? Or actually, are a lot of the things that the book talks about kind of more, I don't know, common sense almost?
I think alchemy is a good word because I think what the book's really trying to showcase is material innovation at the very grassroots. So we're focusing mainly on emerging design talent, designers that are either working individually or in collaboration, whether it be with a manufacturer or a material scientist, to really sort of push a particular material or a particular technology to really take it to its extremes and see how they can really challenge the sort of the current system that we have with materials, which is very linear, this notion of taking, making and discarding. So we've been asked quite extensively, you know, does this have relevance to mass manufacture? But I think what we're trying to showcase is more the sort of front end, that grassroots innovation. So yeah, that if you like, material alchemists that are sort of playing with materials and really using their hands to explore to the nth degree, you know, what a material can do and how they can challenge our current system of how we're utilising materials.
How much does the current system still need challenging? Obviously, you know, when you look at discussions of design, the style has changed quite a lot in recent years. There's a lot more focus on sustainability and social welfare, for example.
I think the current system is still, in terms of production and consumption, is still very linear. Sustainability has been probably of heightened concern and almost like a zeitgeist buzzword for probably the last sort of 5 years or so. So I think this notion of conscious consumption is increasing, but it's, you know, not by any means towards where we should be if we actually want to really, you know, think about that we're a peak resource for many of our raw materials. You know, our water consumption, our energy consumptions are at all-time high, and we're still looking at exponential population increase. So if you put all of those factors together, you know, where we're heading is just not feasible. So we're not as far as we should be.
And it strikes me as interesting, you talk there about especially sort of not niche or niche designers or people working who aren't, you know, producing for the mass market, maybe they're not so established. And you also talk about designers as being the agents for the kind of change that we're talking about here. Mm. Don't they have enough burden on their narrow shoulders already? They've got to be agents of social and environmental change as well. But do you think actually, quite right, you know, these are the creatives. These are the people who are going to have the great ideas. So let's load our expectations up on them. Is it a reasonable, I don't know, is it a reasonable demand to make of designers?
I think they're making it of themselves, to be honest. I mean, I'm heavily connected with design education and ran a course for quite a few years called Material Futures at Central St Martin's. And what I witness and still continue to witness firsthand with all the design institutions that I work with is that designers are actually, and particularly design students, are questioning, you know, what is my role in the 21st century? And how can I, you know, comprehend what I do if I'm continuing to make stuff and output it? Effectively, the most sustainable thing that a designer could do would probably be to stay in bed. So
don't put that message out there. I know a few of these people already. They'll take it literally.
But you know what I mean? Like, you know, they still have this inherent desire to create and to make. So increasingly, we're seeing, you know, as an outlet for that creativity and ingenuity, it's about trying to become a problem solver, I think. And I think that's really the concern for many designers facing, you know, the challenges that we have in the 21st century.
If you look at that problem solving and that grassroots innovation, what are some of the examples you have included in this book that delight you the most?
So I think it's when the designers are really pushing either the material or the system to extremes. So the work of somebody like Dave Hackens, the Dutch designer, his project we feature called Precious Plastics in the chapter, Today's Waste is Tomorrow's Raw Material. And okay, so he sees his role as a designer more as an enabler, so enabling individuals to create a sort of more sustainable ecosystem for themselves. So he's created, everything he does is open source, so he wants to basically create blueprints that you can make yourself. So he created this plastic domestic plastic recycling factory that you, he gives you the instructions, you can create for yourself. It's not necessarily about the products that you can make as a result, because, I mean, they're pretty rudimentary, kind of not necessarily that attractive, recycled plastic products, bowls, clipboards, drawer handles, for example. So it's not so much about the action of you actually making this factory and recycling your own plastic, but the idea, the proposition that you can consider your home as like a closed loop system and start to consider that actually there isn't such a thing as waste, that everything is a resource. He carries through this notion of open source to everything that he does. So, for example, he's you know, his work is effectively doesn't bring him an income. So how does he survive on a day-to-day basis? He puts himself out on Patreon, the crowdsourcing platform. And so you can contribute, you know, whether it be like a euro a month to 20 euros a month to allow Dave Hackens to continue as a designer maker.
Talking about resources and talking about recycling, I have to ask about one title of a chapter and what it entails. I wonder, first of all, how commercially viable are some materials? You have this chapter that's aptly called Shit Hair Dust.
Yeah, Shit Hair Dust is basically looking at this premise that as we have more people populating the planet than ever before, effectively the material that is becoming most abundant is biological material. So more people, more hair growth equals more hair, you know, available as a resource, and equally more shit. And I think one of the most interesting examples within that chapter is the Mier de Cotta project, where an Italian dairy farmer is using the byproduct of his cattle farm to basically, so the methane that the cows produce, obviously he farms the milk, the methane the cows produce creates all the energy, and then he collects cow shit and basically has created this sort of innovative clay and created a series of products, including domestic tableware, which we have in our studio, the shit plate, that's basically usable on a daily basis. So I suppose it's kind of igniting your imagination to reconsider biological material, but also providing, you know, alternative material sources.
Well, I want to ask about this because obviously the book is a really interesting primer on this, and it will obviously win additional fans, one imagines, in the design community who are more in the vanguard of asking some of these tough questions. But in terms of, we talked about the mass market at the beginning, and if we're talking about reusing materials, sure, I can see people saying, oh, I get why I would want a pair of Adidas sneakers that are made out of reclaimed ocean plastic. It all joins up. And for the consumer, you say, oh, I may even pay a premium because that's good for the planet. If it's something like a cup for your home that's made of excrement, even bovine rather than human, there's a whole nother degree of, I don't know, what are you calling on the consumer there? A bit of empathy? It's a different proposition, isn't it? There's sort of shades of grey or brown in this case in terms of convincing people. Can the book, are you hoping the book can play a role? Is that too lofty an ambition?
And I think it's about really trying to encourage what started this concern for provenance, this concern to actually understand the ingredients that go into the products that surround us. And I think, like the food industry, you know, consumption of mass-produced goods, we've been too divorced from the making process, and particularly from the raw materials that are going into the products and the processes that they go through. I think, you know, it's pertinent to try and remind ourselves that everything is ultimately animal, vegetable or mineral. It comes from a natural source, and it's the processes that we, you know, put these materials through that transforms them. And then ultimately, what do we do with them afterwards? So I think a lot of the case studies are really playing to that concern for, to continue this concern for provenance.
And if you look at waste as a resource, as material, is there anything that doesn't really work for these kind of purposes?
Really, it's about trying to move towards a more circular model, essentially. And I know that circularity is the sort of, again, is the one of the key buzzwords in sustainability and design circles at the moment. So, I mean, we're working on a new project with Dutch in Virtuals, which will culminate in an exhibition at Milan Design Week. And there we're trying to actually challenge, you know, should waste even be in our vocabulary anymore? Because effectively, materials are materials, you know, everything is a resource. And I think it's long been said, this notion of throwing away, there isn't such a thing as a way, as we can see, you know, by landfill that are completely, you know, full to bursting. So if we almost remove or reinvent the word waste in our vocabulary, I think there could be some really interesting results.
And to this point of a materials revolution. I know that's something you've spoken about before, and obviously it's sort of this theme is there in the book. Is that what it's going to take? I mean, often you imagine that you need more of a gradual process as these sort of seismic changes in the way you know people's public perception and so on. But do we need a revolution? Do we need something that's more sort of rigorous in terms of what we're asking of people?
I think the revolution that we're talking about is the convergence of factors. It's the combination of the heightened consumer awareness, which is as a result of reportage of the detriment of mass production and consumption. It's a combination of increased capability in science and technology. So biological science and material innovation is at an all-time high. Technological innovation in terms of digital fabrication is also paving the way for a perhaps more localised and smaller scale, but still globally connected manufacturing revolution. So it's a kind of convergence of the sociocultural factors and the mindset shifts along with the capabilities of science and technology that is paving the potential effectively. So I think, and that's what we're trying to sort of showcase in the book, is that those two really strong factors are now coming together to have this potential of a materials revolution of which can, you know, really pave this way towards a sustainable future.
Well, more power to you. The book that documents this is Radical Matter, Rethinking Materials for a Sustainable Future. It's by Kate Franklin and Caroline Till. It's published by Thames and Hudson. Out now, I guess?
Out this week.
So do get your copy. Caroline Till, one of the authors, thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24, Tom Edwards and Marco Sippi in the chairs. Now, Marcus, we'll be hearing from Eliades Ochoa in just a moment. I'm excited.
But first, let's hear him in action.
You're not wrong, Marcus. This is Buena Vista Social Club with El Cuarto de Tula. Buena Vista Social Club there with El Cuarto de Tula.
Grammy-winning Cuban guitarist and vocalist Eliades Ochoa is a member of the legendary group of musicians Buena Vista Social Club. The collective found worldwide acclaim in the 1990s after transporting the sounds of Cuba to recording studios and sold-out venues around the world. He's also well-known for his own solo albums and the work with his own bands such as Grupo Patria.
Eliades will be performing at London's Royal Albert Hall in April as part of La Linnea, the London Latin Music Festival. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with him and an interpreter to learn more about his career and the music of Cuba. Tom began by asking whether much-storied venues like the Albert Hall here in London are some of his favourites in which to play, and how long it's been since he was last in the country.
No. So I have not been playing here recently, not in the last few weeks or months, but I have played many times here in very different venues before. It's no secret that the most famous record ever made by Cuban musicians, a record that traveled around the world, the Buena Vista Social Club Project, was recorded here and was born here in London. So I feel very happy to know that I'll soon be playing at the Royal Albert Hall. It's a historic venue. Playing there will be written in my artistic curriculum. I know that not every musician gets to play in such a famous place, so it is great to know I am one of the chosen ones. It makes me really happy.
Los artistas seleccionados, y yo tengo esa alegría de que me hayan seleccionado.
You must have played in so many different rooms. Do you prefer a big room, a small cafe? What's the best kind of place to enjoy this sort of music?
Bueno, yo tengo confianza.
I'm confident. That's why I like big venues. But I am also confident that many people will assist me, not only listen to me. I understand the value of Cuban music. But those who are attending know the richness and quality of Cuban music too. That's why I invite everyone to come together while we play.
A todos, a que estemos juntos allí ese día.
Oh, I want to come on to the different strands of Cuban music because the members of Buena Vista Social Club come from different parts of Cuba and bring their own culture. Can you tell us about your own musical story and how your style fits into the wider sound of Buena Vista Social Club?
Bueno, en el Buena Vista Social Club.
I'm still bringing to Buena Vista Social Club the same things that I would bring when I was growing up in the mountains, far away. The repertoire in Cuban music is very wide. There is so much. There is son, there is guaracha, there is changui, there's mambo. Lots of different strands. But the things that I do well are bolero and son cubano. It's also known as son montuno, as it was the name of the music played by the people who used to work the land. But nowadays we know it as son cubano.
Pero en realidad es el son cubano.
Do you think that people have misconceptions about Cuba and Cuban music? Because I think that people see Cuba as not a huge island. So are you surprised when people perhaps don't understand the complexity of the music and the makeup of the place?
Yo me he puesto a pensar.
I've been thinking that maybe scientists should be consulted regarding the processes of Cuban music. In Santiago de Cuba, where I'm from, the earth trembles and shakes daily. So when a son montuno is played, people shake and dance too. The land shakes, the sun is hotter there than other places, and rum is drunk with no ice. But all the musicians live to be 90 years old. So that's something scientists need to analyze.
Tienen que hacerse cargo de eso. No sabría yo.
That's interesting. Okay. So does that way of thinking inform your lyrics and ideas?
Bueno, en la música que hago.
It's not just about my music. It's more that whenever a son montuno is played, people shake and they can't stand still. It needs to be analyzed. And yes, in Santiago de Cuba, the earth shakes every day. We don't always feel it, but machines record it.
Pero que nosotros no lo sentimos, no nos enteramos, pero todos los días tiembla.
So it's, I guess, in a funny way, rhythm is just subconsciously within everyone all the time because it's kind of shaking all the time.
Yo creo que sí.
Yes, I think so. Either everyone has music inside them or has a drink inside them. In Santiago de Cuba, whoever doesn't play an instrument gets played. Have you ever been to Santiago de Cuba?
Nunca he visitado Santiago de Cuba.
I have not, sadly. I need to go.
Tocados por manos de negros cubanos que hayan jurado tocar su tambor.
I also wanted to talk about the history of Cuban music because one of the things that we're told as outsiders about the stories of Buena Vista Social Club is that before the revolution, the culture was crazy and festive and exuberant, and perhaps post that era, something was lost a little bit. But is that feeling now being passed on to a new generation?
No, la música cubana.
I don't see how Cuban music has anything to do with revolutions or war at all. Before, in the past, people and musicians were not able to travel. They had to ask the government for permission to leave the country. Nowadays, it's totally different. You just go to the embassy of the country you'd like to visit, get a visa, and as soon as you get it, you go home, take your passports, and off you go. It could be the case that in the past, the music wasn't promoted enough around the world, as musicians weren't able to travel. So since the birth of the Buena Vista Social Club, and the fact that we traveled around the world many times, young musicians have realized the importance of traditional Cuban music, and how people really like it all over the world. They have noticed how important it is to keep the tradition. That's why many young musicians are making traditional Cuban music now. When visitors go to Cuba, what they want to hear is Cuban music, and young musicians have realized it too. They keep the Cuban music alive.
Pero mantienen la música cubana viva. La música cubana tiene mucha salud hoy en día.
Aside from Buena Vista Social Club, your other projects and solo work have seen you releasing close to one album maybe every 2 years or so. What's your next project?
Estoy trabajando como cinco cosas distintas.
I am actually continuously working on about five different things. I'm still working with and will keep working with the Buena Vista Social Club. At the request of the world, the few existing members of Buena Vista Social Club will go on tour around the world very soon. I also have my own quartet. It's called Cuarteto Patria. I have also recently recorded an album with around 20 musicians that has been awarded 4 Grammys.
Uno de ellos, Elías de Ochoa.
Pero donde tú miras, que no vaya mi pensamiento. Donde tú irás, donde tú irás.
And there is also my solo work, Eliades with a guitar, just me playing. Nowadays, I'm very pleased and happy whether I'm with Cuarteto Patria, with Buena Vista Social Club, or alone with my guitar. For the Royal Albert Hall, we have a humongous show prepared. It's going to be big, and we already know that not everyone plays there. That's why I'm very happy for the invitation. It'll be a day full of surprises. We will have a fantastic musician called December Bueno, who is a composer of songs like Súbeme la Radio or Bailando, played by bands like Gente de Zona. He also composed a song named Preciosa. You can find them all on YouTube. Great artists like that will be there. But as long as I can do Cuban traditional music, a music that gives me strength, I feel great. It doesn't matter where in the world I play it.
Para hacerla en cualquier parte del mundo.
I wanted to ask, are there any dream collaborators you haven't worked with yet?
No, la verdad que no.
To be honest, no. If someone asks me for a collaboration, I'll do it. But I would never stop doing traditional Cuban music. I will die playing Son Cubano. Of course, if someone that knows my work asks me for a collaboration, I'll do it. I'm always very happy to collaborate with artists, such as I did with Afrocubismo and will do with December Bueno.
Lo hago, no tengo ningún inconveniente.
You had the very unique pleasure of playing at the White House. Did you get to meet Barack Obama? And if you did you have any opinion when you met him?
Sí, la verdad que sí. El presidente Obama nos recibió.
We were in the White House and I had the opportunity to meet President Obama. He greeted us, he signed and gave his book to my wife. He was very welcoming. He even spoke Spanish with us. He told us that when he was younger, around 20 years ago, he bought the first album by Buena Vista Social Club. He took some pictures with us and I still have it, and it's very dear to my heart because you have to think this is a historic moment that happens to only some of us. He had a sort of juvenile, fresh smile. He had the smile of a humble person. He also came from the bottom, just like me. That's life. And he went to Cuba. When he was there, I was not there. But I know he went and shared time with the Cuban people, and he felt great there. So we finally met Barack Obama, the President of the United States, and Eliades Ochoa, President of Cuarteto Patria.
Embajador del mundo. Música del mundo.
Finally, for people starting out learning the guitar, what's more important, skill or creativity?
Yo creo que la guitarra, lo primero que tiene que tener alguien...
The main thing, the most important for anybody new to the guitar and who tries to learn the guitar is that they need to love the instrument and want to do it. It does not have to be a duty. You must not do it because you are forced to. You do it because you love it. You also need to give it some time and attention. You can't leave it in a closet. You need to give it time every single day, like a woman. This is the only way to do it. I never went to a music school. I do not know how to read music. I have no idea about pentatonics. I learned by listening. Going to school is very important, but I cannot tell anybody to do that because I have never been to school. But the thing is, you do it because you love it, and you keep playing the music you really, really love.
Que tengan con personas que tengan ese tipo de conocimiento.
The legendary Eliades Ochoa there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And you can catch Eliades at the Albert Hall here in London on the 25th of April, and the La Linnea Festival runs from the 20th to the 30th of that month. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. How far can you make your money go? It's a question many of us ask at the beginning and end of every month. But our next guest today has been looking at the question in rather more detail.
Economist and broadcaster Darshini David's new book, The Almighty Dollar, traces one single dollar's journey around the world, from Main Street America to the oil fields of Iraq via China's central bank and beyond. How do the dollars in circulation move, and where will they be headed in future? Darshini joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Let's first talk about the importance dollar still has as lifeblood of globalization. Why is it still the dollar that is in such a strong position instead of, say, a euro?
Interesting question that. You would have thought, you know, the dollar's been around for hundreds of years. It's time to sort of cede a bit of power. And actually, when you look at the population in Europe who use the euro, there's more of them than there are Americans using the dollar. So surely that should mean that the balance of power has shifted. And in fact, when the euro came about, a lot of American bankers were really quite scared, saying, this is it. The dollar's days are numbered. Hasn't quite happened, partly because when Europe came together to have the euro there, they kind of fudged it a bit. So you've got a lot of different countries using it with different kind of economies, different political systems, unlike the dollar. So that meant that the euro didn't get off to the best start. The financial crisis came along and all the fault lines were exposed. You could see Greece on the one hand, Germany the other. So confidence isn't quite there. At the same time, the dollar is still the currency we use mainly for trading. That goes back to, well, after the Second World War. It's the currency that oil's priced in. It's the currency that a lot of debts are priced in. Why? It's seen as stable. Central banks like holding on to it because they need it for trade, and it's also good for other kinds of payments. And when it comes to times of trouble, we tend to turn to the dollar. I mean, the Argentinian economic crises, it wasn't pesos people were putting under the bed. It was dollars. Moscow, if you go back to even the Cold War, back then you had hotels, even prostitutes, accepting dollars because there were stores which had took hard currencies and it spoke a different language to using the ruble. So that sort of success of the dollar and its popularity has yet to wane. I mean, of course, there's all these digital currencies coming up, so we could be having a different conversation in the years to come.
I don't think we need to worry about that just yet, if limited reading of the likely efficacy of those is anything to go by. So look, it's the almighty dollar. It's still really the global currency. And I guess your book traces the moves of a dollar sort of nominally around the world. But I guess it's sort of implicit in all this is the idea that it's the currency of global trade. And obviously there's lots of interesting discussion at the moment about how, you know, the current incumbent in the Oval Office and so others are, if not falling out of love with global trade, they're underestimating or misunderstanding what global trade means. I guess as an economist, first and foremost, global trade is a good thing, and it's not a bad time to maybe remind people about that.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think, and I forgot to put him down in the acknowledgements there, but the man in the Oval Office has a lot to answer for, because it was him coming to power and indeed the rise of this sort of feeling that we need to build up walls, you know, trade walls, other kinds of walls around the world, which first got me thinking about the fact that we don't really understand how the global economy works, and the fact that globalisation and trade has become, you know, they've become pretty much dirty words in some circles. But when you look at what President Trump's trying to do at the moment, for example, put tariffs, charges on things coming in, and that's part of making America great again, because if you make some imports more expensive, people will buy American, and, you know, American companies will produce more, there'll be more American jobs. That's the theory. What happens in practice is prices go up. Europe goes, okay, we're going to start slapping charges on things like orange juice and Levi's and Harley Davidson's. And that hurts American workers who are trying to make those things. So ultimately, what you end up with higher prices, less trade going on, less income, less jobs. So building those kind of walls are not a good thing. And that's one of the reasons, as you say, why I thought this is time to write this book to explain these kind of things. Because when you look at it on the face of it, if you talk about making America great again, it's about protecting your industries. But are you actually protecting them, or are you sort of opening yourself up to all kinds of problems?
Exactly. And you do indeed follow the journey of a single dollar around the world to see how the global economy really works. It's fascinating. Well over $1 trillion are actually currently outside of the American borders. Where are they mostly?
Well, under beds, obviously. No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I started looking at this, I thought, yeah, it's the American currency. There's a few other countries around the world who have adopted the dollar as their own. But, you know, very few indeed. And that's largely because they're concerned about the stability of their own currencies. But it's used everywhere. If you go to the other side of the world, if you're an aid worker and you want to get your hands on some equipment very fast, start flashing the cash in dollars, you're going to get that pretty quickly. That kind of money talks. So, yeah, it's used in trade. And therefore, it's used by central banks as well. China earns the dollars from America, tends to keep them in sort of dollar-type assets. And also, half the world's debts are actually denominated in dollars, which sounds really weird, isn't it? If you took out a mortgage, why on earth would you take it out in dollars? But if you're doing trade, or if you're borrowing as a company from another country, or a country borrowing from another country, and you want to be sure of the value of that debt, you know what you're repaying, the dollar's a pretty safe thing to have it in. So it's very popular outside of the walls, or rather, not the walls, the borders of America, we should still say. Indeed, in countries where you have got concerns about the stability of your own currency, your own economy, I mentioned Argentina, even still, if you go to Russia as well, that hard currency does hold a certain weight as being seen as more secure. So, yeah, so half of the notes in circulation are outside of America. It's strange.
Doshi, let me ask you a little bit about the general level of economic acumen that's out there. A lot of conversation within our borders, certainly here in the UK, where a large number of our listeners are, of course, about, people didn't understand the fundamentals of the Brexit vote. They didn't understand the economic implications. And this has provoked a more broader discussion about how economically illiterate people are or are not. You're obviously an economist by training, and you've been working as an economist, a broadcaster on economics for what, couple of decades, give or take.
That's the right way of putting it.
do you despair at the lack of intelligent discourse on this for the mass market? I mean, we all know we can find great writing in journals and in academe. Do you worry about, particularly, I guess, maybe the younger generation, or in terms of Brexit voters, the older generation?
I worry about everyone, I think, is a short answer to that one. And as you very politely put it, I've been a broadcaster for a while. I used to work in the city as an economist before that. And one of the reasons I swapped one for the other, and by the way, wasn't the best choice in terms of personal economics to move from the city into broadcasting. But one of the things that really did frustrate me then was that people didn't get economics. And even now, if you go into our newsrooms up and down the countries and you talk to some of the senior editors, they say to you, people don't understand it, but it's something we've got to talk about. And you think, well, if you're looking at it like that, then there's something wrong here. We were told ahead of the Brexit referendum that people didn't get economics. In fact, the economics didn't matter. It does matter to people, but they just didn't know what they were grappling with. And that's partly the fault of broadcasters as well, is because everyone got swept away by the spin and no one sat there and goes, right, OK, these are the issues. They're really not that hard. They're not that painful. But if you don't understand them, you don't know what you're voting for.
How different would the world be if all people actually understood economics?
Very. I think. At the moment, economics is seen as a preserve of the few. I was in Davos earlier this year at the World Economic Forum, which is quite an experience in itself. And you see all these business leaders and you see, you know, political leaders, and they're all sitting there on the highest town in Europe, sipping their 50 franc, glasses of champagne and talking over their, $100 croque monsieurs and looking forward to sleeping in their $1,000 beds at night, which is what it is up there, frankly. And they're discussing inequality and poverty against this sort of soundtrack, if you like, of champagne corks popping in these five-star hotels. And we think of those people as the people who understand the economy, the people who are driving all the economic forces. And we're, you know, to use the kind of language that's been used about Brexit, we're the rule takers. We're sitting there going, OK, we'll wait for you to tell us what's going to happen to our fortunes and our jobs, and it's all in your hands. I think if we understood a bit more, and this is what I've been trying to do with this book, is to say, well, each transaction, each choice we make has implications. So, I start off with an American shopper in a Walmart buying, you know, like we all do when we go into one of these shops, just putting in an impulse purchase at the end, and it's a radio made in China, and looking at the implication that has in terms of jobs and income in our own country, also for China and what it means for its power around the globe. And I think if you kind of understand very simple transactions like that, you begin to see how what we do plays a role in all of this and how you can influence what happens to us. And ultimately, we're talking about our jobs, our prosperity and our properties.
Is there a problem? It's interesting you paint that vivid and I think very accurate picture of Davos, this sort of rarefied in every manner of speaking, and this idea of people who are slightly above the day-to-day, be it in the detail of their everyday lives or their way they look at the big economic picture. Is that a problem too? And I guess this dates back almost a decade now if we look to the financial crisis, and a language entered the common parlance talking, that was more about finance rather than economics broadly, but everyone seemed to get bracketed in together. And there was a reluctance to engage from, you know, the public, if we can generalise. And people became very cynical about economists. Yes. They became cynical about people who tried to talk about prudence in finance and in the economy. Are we still suffering from the damage that was done around that time, do you think?
I think we definitely are. And I think you made a really good point there, in the sense that you would think, wouldn't you, that having been through that crisis, we'd all be sitting there going, we want to understand what happened there, because this impacted on me. What happened there? How did this happen? Whose fault is it? Instead of which, it does feel very much like this was something that's way too complex. It was too complex for the authorities to understand. They didn't see it coming. The experts didn't see it coming. So how should the rest of us have known what was going on. And surely that is makes it even more mysterious. And, you know, look at The Wolf of Wall Street and you've got a Hollywood actress in a bath with a glass of champagne to actually explain what all these products actually were. It doesn't have to be that hard. And I think there's some very simple things you've got to understand about the financial crisis. And that is there were, you know, there were bankers making money out of all sorts of things. And they were actually developing these things faster than the people policing the system could keep up. And it meant they were lending money to people who shouldn't have been lent money to. And because of the way our systems were all linked, ultimately we all suffered.
And if you look at how the world economy works at the moment, one of the things you're obviously writing about is free trade. What are your views now? Is free trade really always a good thing?
I think there's definitely, and this is one of the things I've kind of gone into details. There are exceptions, obviously, because we look at, if you take the example we were talking about earlier about Trump and what's going on there with tariffs, for everyday transactions, there isn't much rationale there. If you look at the way the trends have moved in recent decades, we've been pulling down trade barriers. There's a very good reason for that. It means that, you know, ultimately, we enjoy a higher standard of living because prices come down. We tend to produce more. There's more jobs around. And also, countries develop faster and they respond to the way that the world's changing. You're not stuck there still making, I don't know, you know, record players when the world's moved on and it's all about the iPhone. But it's interesting because the argument Trump used to put up these trade barriers was that things like steel are what he calls strategic. What does that actually mean? It means that things that are crucial to your country's survival. And there's some things which undoubtedly, when you think about, probably are. I mean, things like food, things like energy. Yeah, there's a really good reason for thinking that, yeah, we have to be able to be self-sufficient in those. And some countries use that as a reason to put up trade barriers. Understand that. If you're a really poor country and you're saying, well, actually, those big guys have got a head start on me, how am I going to develop my industry without being choked? Sometimes you can put up barriers there. Those kind of arguments, and I think there are those kind of exceptions, but they're very much the exceptions.
Dashini, I was put in mind, browsing your book, of an old film from the early 90s called, I think it's called 20 Bucks, that followed a $20 bill around only Minneapolis. It didn't have a global reach. And I was wondering, the almighty dollar, it would lend itself very much to the big screen treatment. Could that be the next step? Just briefly, could you go from small screen to silver screen? It's Dashini travelling around the world following this dollar around.
That would be fantastic,
around. Wouldn't it?
I think it definitely would. I should state, because what I've done in the book is I've used, you know, a series of episodes in different countries around the globe. I have to stress, those are actually fictional. Before I get anybody coming up saying, hang on a minute, there's a Russian arms dealer in there. It's like, yeah, that is pure fiction. But it could be like McMafia, couldn't it, for the economic sake?
It almost writes itself, except, yeah. Of course, you would write it. Well, and it would probably be better for it.
Well, there you go. So I'll have to give you credit for that now.
Very good stuff on the book. The book is The Almighty Dollar. The writer is Dashini. Dashini, thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you so much.
And that's almost all for this edition of the Monocle Weekly. That went quickly.
It flew by, Marcus, and I have to say, I feel like I have been educated.
I was just going to say,
enlightened, entertained, and that's just the ease.
Are you going to get a selection of those plates we discussed earlier now, Tom?
I might do. Well, there's a thought for you, listeners, wherever you may be. To wrap up this 453rd edition of the Monocle Weekly, Marcus, let's thank the people behind the glass, the programme.
Quite a few people to thank this time, actually.
It's a busy crew, led by our inspirational producer, Tom Hall, and our researchers, Tom Melville and Pierre-Antoine Denis.
Thanks also to Sofia Mardi and Malcolm Chachoklian.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Margus Hippie. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.